Somebody has been attacked and hurt. We were running too fast to admit of more being said, and we made no stop until we got into our kitchen. It was full of people. The whole village was there, or in the yard. And there was a surgeon, and there was Joe, and there was a group of women, all on the floor in the midst of the kitchen. The unemployed bystanders drew back when they saw me, and so I became aware of my sister, lying without sense or movement on the bare boards where she had been knocked down by a tremendous blow on the back of the head, dealt by some unknown hand when her face was turned towards the fire, destined never to be on the rampage again while she was the wife of Joe. That's the cliffhanger ending of one installment of Charles Dickens' Great Expectations, leaving its readers to wait for weeks to find out what happened next. Similarly, thousands of Americans lined the shore waiting for the next installment of Dickens' Old Curiosity Shop to arrive from across the Atlantic, as they wanted to see if Little Nell would live or die. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Today we are used to hour-long television soap operas and dramas that leave us hanging, but we rarely read books that way anymore. In the 19th century, Charles Dickens, Anthony Trollope, Elizabeth Gaskell, Wilkie Collins, William Makepeace Thackeray, George Eliot, Henry James, and other Victorians published many of their novels serially or in short pieces over a period of months, allowing a broader audience to encounter their fiction. What difference did it make to the literature of the time that so much of it was published serially? What do we miss as modern readers if we try to tackle a lengthy Victorian novel in its bulk form? Is the explosion of new media today, such as iPads, Kindles, blogs, and Twitter, transforming the way we read and write, bringing us closer to the 19th century process of serialization? Joining us to explore Victorian serialization is Susan David Bernstein, professor of English at the UW-Madison, and the founder of an experimental serialization project using web resources to analyze and recreate the experience of an earlier era.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
That sounds intriguing. The last thing that Emily mentioned there, would certainly get into that before the conversation is done. What was it about the Victorian age, though, that made that period so ripe for serialization? I mean, certainly the books in the 18th century were big enough. You know, Tom Jones is not exactly an overnight read, and
right. There
are many in its company.
Right. I think it was a combination of factors that converged, including rising literacy rates, including a growing lower middle class with a work-a-day schedule, so there wouldn't be long, long stretches for reading time in the evening. Although I will say that reading installments became a sort of family ritual. Charles Darwin writes about that in his letters, how he and Emma Darwin read installments of The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins out loud in the evenings to their many children. And there were changes in publishing, in the technology of publishing, too, that made it easier to efficiently publish shorter installments. And then in terms of the cost with advertising, a whole array of factors, I think this cheaper and more frequent mode of publishing became possible. And I also wanted to mention the circulating libraries, you know, like Moody's Circulating Library, which we don't think about that, but prior to the serialization in magazine installments or in monthly part little pamphlets, they actually look like, they're, you know, novels typically from the late 18th through the 19th century were published in three volumes. And people would subscribe to the circulating libraries for a volume at a time. And so that's also a kind of serial, right? Mm-hmm. And I think novelists were very accustomed to writing in the three-volume format. And this was an innovation that Dickens really exploited to write not in three installments, but as many as 20.
Keep them strung along.
Yeah. So would you date the beginning then, really, of the Victorian serialization with Charles Dickens and Pickwick Papers?
I definitely would. And I think my scholars in this area would certainly agree. Pickwick Papers is considered Dickens' first novel. It was preceded by sketches by Boz, which was sort of the segue from his career as a journalist. And Sketches by Boz was enormously popular, and they came out initially in magazines, and there were 56 short sketches of characters, of scenes, etc., all around London. And then Pickwick became, you know, this club of the Pickwickians and their various adventures in London, the countryside, wherever. And what was interesting is there was a huge, a huge explosion of popularity. There were Sam Weller joke books. There were stage adaptations. There was a whole sort of merchandise craze around Pickwick. But they were actually episodes, sort of self-contained, an adventure each month.
Well, I was going to say, how much of a tight plot could you have with a serialization where there might be how many days elapsing between the availability of episodes?
Dickens published all of his novels in the serial form, but they were divided into either weekly or monthly installments. So Great Expectations, for instance, that was a weekly serial, where the installments came out each week, published in his magazine all the year round. The same with Tale of Two Cities, the same with Hard Times. I think there were five in all. But the majority of them were actually published in monthly installments, a month at a time, slightly longer than the weekly ones, usually around four chapters. And that was one of the questions I had, was how did readers manage with, a whole month to remember and make the connection, especially as Dickens continued to write, rather elaborately plotted stories. We think of, Oliver Twist was the next one, but then we get to something like Bleak House, where there are two narrators, or we get to Dombey and Son, or David Copperfield, or Our Mutual Friend.
And Dickens was just, in his 20s when he started Pickwick Papers? Did he have any idea that this format would skyrocket him to fame?
I don't think he did, but he was clever.
And what made him decide at this point with Pickwick Papers to publish it in this new format? Was it mostly economic, wanting more readers who couldn't afford a whole book?
I think that was part of it. And he was a good businessman.
And a journalist.
And he had the experience as a journalist. And remember, a journalist is somebody who writes in a daily fashion, So his whole concept of fictional entertainment was very much shaped by his experience as a journalist.
I would think a novelist would start hearing from people and sort of adapting his or her writing accordingly, just the way television writers, if the ratings go up or down, they can throw out a character. How does it affect someone like a Dickens or like a Thackeray when they start getting reader response?
Well, there is quite a bit of evidence, actually, that Dickens did pay attention to how readers were responding, especially, that is one advantage of the monthly schedule, is that there was
time to get the feedback.
Right. And actually, this surprised me. I just hadn't even thought about this before I started doing research. But those, each part number or installment of the monthly serials, like David Copperfield or Bleak House, were reviewed in periodicals of the day. Dickens' fourth number of Bleak House or the fourth number of David Copperfield just came out this week, and then there would be all this discussion about it. And sometimes there'd be letters to the editor of various magazines writing about it. And I found this one letter that so surprised me. It was about Bleak House, where the reader said he'd found it kind of boring, uninteresting, the first several installments. He put it down. He didn't read a few. And then he picked up installment 12, which is when Esther Summerson and Lady Dedlock meet. And there's some very startling revelations. I don't want to give away the plot for those who love the pleasure of the plot suspense. But it just never occurred to me that people actually did read Dickens in parts and even skip parts, just like we might watch our favorite serial on television, Mad Men or whatever. And you can still keep up with the story if you miss a couple of the episodes, right?
Well, that might account for some of the lengthy asides and digressions that you find in some of these 19th century novels. And speaking of asides, this was also done on the continent, too. I mean, would somebody like Victor Hugo have been serialized?
Yes. I think there were, you know, many novelists I'm not as familiar with, but yes, but they were serialized, too. There's a French word for this, which is escaping me now, but yes.
What made you particularly interested in this format?
I'm glad you asked me that question. I think it was really the experience of teaching Dickens in the classroom where, I was very fond of teaching Bleak House and Our Mutual Friend, both very long, hefty novels. And my students, you know, found it ponderous and, you know, oh, it's so saccharine or, you know, there's so much description. And then I started thinking, well, if you're only reading Dickens in parceled out bits, it goes down in a very different way. So then I started experimenting with this, and I know a lot of other people who teach Victorian novels do this, where I actually did a Dickens novel where we read an installment or two a week throughout the 15-week semester to try to replicate as much as possible that experience. And you do read the novel differently that way.
How much does it affect you? I mean, is it just that you get it in small doses so you can take certain things better? Or
yes, you take it in small doses, and that also allows you to, it's reading at a slower pace. So it's what I call slow reading, where you also see the nice variation in the different kinds of, you know, plot lines and characters that often occur within one installment, which you wouldn't notice otherwise. So one scholar named Jennifer Hayward, who's written a book called Consuming Pleasures on the Serial Form, she has a chapter on soap operas, a chapter on comic strips, and a chapter on Dickens. She notes that in a Dickens novel, there would usually be a comic relief scene. There'd usually be a scene with a lot of suspense, often towards the end of an installment. You know, and the installments would sort of alternate between different kinds of characters. So you don't see that, of course, when you're just totally immersing yourself. It's a different reading experience, right? When you're just totally immersing yourself and reading those 800 pages straight through.
Well, it's the same way that poetry tends to be taught, for example. Poetry is a classic example of what needs to be read slowly.
Yes.
And yet, if as a student, for example, you're presented with 800 pages of romantic poetry, it's pretty hard to appreciate that lyrical ballads came out in a small book that you could read over and over.
Right. Right. You just notice things differently. And you notice different things, different features.
I would think it'd be scary for a novelist to start publishing something serially that wasn't even finished. Because you've got deadlines and
You have built up great expectations.
Yes. Yes. But I think that's so important to keep in mind that especially Dickens, but this was true with George Eliot, with Romola, for instance, which was her one novel that was serialized in a magazine over 13 months in 13 parts. And she was a couple of installments ahead. And that was always true for Dickens, too. He's one or two installments ahead. But it does sort of change our whole idea of how novelists worked, right? We mm-hmm. think, you know, it's this, you know, sort of elaborate, intricate design that they map out and then they put into execution. But in fact, there is a lot of sort of daily randomness, because these novels were written over a period of a year and a half. I mean, many mm-hmm. of these Dickens serials actually came out over 19 months or 18 months. So a year and a half.
Makes you wonder a little bit if there wasn't an example of an author who, stretching this thing out over a year and a half, you know, didn't die or something before the thing got out through its last installment. What a nuisance that would be.
It did happen. The Mystery of Edwin Drood.
Oh, that was serialized,
yes.
Of course.
Yes, it was supposed to be 12 installments, and Dickens died only after completing the sixth.
Quite a mystery.
Yes.
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 And wasn't it Martin Chuzzlewit where he saw the ratings were going down and sent Martin to America?
That's the story, yes. Yeah. That is the story, that he sends Barton to America. But he had also just published his American Notes in General Circulation, which is about his own travels in America, which is quite Pickwickian in that it's very episodic. But that is a story. I just taught Martin Chuzzlewit for the first time.
And were there some novelists of the time who sort of were disdainful of this form and said, I will not kind of descend to this popular form, taking my novel and putting it in popular pieces?
Yes. George Eliot struggled with that form. Elizabeth Gaskell struggled with that form. It's interesting. Dickens commissioned Gaskell for a novel for his magazine, Household Words, and the novel was North and South. Her whole style of composition was even, she didn't even like putting in chapter demarcations, let alone serial installments, and having to be mindful of having a sort of specific word limit for each installment, that it had to be roughly these many words or pages. She couldn't deal with that. So she would send Dickens just all these manuscript pages without even chapter divisions. And then he put all that in, and she was often not happy with what he cut out. And there is quite a bit.
Here's your money, your takes, your choice. Oh, that does raise an interesting question, though, about the difference between a chapter and a serial episode.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think there's been a lot of interest in how novels are shaped by chapters, how chapters divide novels. And we often think a chapter is a perfectly logical place to pause, right? But I'm interested in thinking about the chapter in relation to the serial installment, because that was, in fact, the place one had to pause. You could think about the chapter in relation to a commercial break if you're watching a television serial. That's when you get up and you leave the room and you do something else. But with the installment, that's it. You have to wait until the next installment. So I'm, looking at that. I know other scholars who are sort of very interested in the chapter and what chapterness means. And I want to look at chapterness in relationship to the serial installment.
But you would, as an author and as a publisher, you would want a cliffhanger there. You wouldn't want an episode to end and to pat away.
Right. But people really varied with that. I mean, I think there also became a kind of struggle in terms of pandering to the reader and to publishers and the need to bring them back for the next episode and whatever
the
higher objectives or the aesthetic objectives of a particular writer were. I know that Henry James was not at all happy with the serial format, but in fact his early novels, including The Portrait of a Lady, was published in serial installments simultaneously in a British magazine and in an American magazine.
I don't think of Henry James as being really big on cliffhangers. Did he write that way?
He did not. However, if you know that the novel was initially written and published in serial form, then you read through the installments with attention to where they end, you do see that. And I'm currently doing Washington Square on my blog, which I can talk about later. And I actually brought the ending of the installment
Let's get to that now. I mean, what do you mean by on your blog when you say you're going through Washington Square?
So almost 4 years ago, in the spring of 2008, I decided, all my friends were, had reading blogs of one sort or another, so I thought, I'm going to do a serial readers blog, and that's what my blog is. You can Google Serial Readers Dickens and find my blog. The first novel that we began reading on my serial readers blog was Dickens' Dombey and Son, and the way this worked is Dombey and Son was published in monthly installments, and with the last in 20 monthly installments, with the last installment a double installment, so actually over 19 months. What I do on my blog is by the week. So each week I would read an installment, and then I would write a short response to that installment.
You would read an installment?
Read it to yourself?
Read it to myself.
Would you also post the installment?
No.
No, you'd assume people can find...
Right. When possible, if there was an electronic version available, and that is increasingly possible, I would link that to the website so people could do it that way. But I also always give the chapter segments, so chapters 1 to 4 for the first installment in case people are actually reading a book. But the project or the plan is you read one installment a week. Now, actually, these novels came out with one installment a month, so we're accelerating. But it's still a much slower reading process than mm-hmm. how people ordinarily read these novels.
Now, how has that affected you as a reader, as a scholar, to do this project for 4 years? How has it changed how you've seen these novels?
Well, as I was saying, I see features of the novels differently, because I'm reading them slowly over time. And I also occasionally I've had an entry on the blog where I talk about the other reading I do every week. So it's not as if, you know, Dombey and Son is the only novel I'm reading on a particular, you know, day or week. I'm also reading another novel. I'm also reading a variety of other kinds of materials.
So what's on the blog is your response to that particular reading?
To that installment, and then people who join in, and I've always had people joining in, they post comments. And sometimes they'll comment on what I've said, sometimes they'll comment on something they noticed, and that's a lot of fun too.
So in a way, this is sort of an approximate recreation of the experience the author would have had when the thing was serialized in the first place.
You know, that is sort of what I'm aiming for. I just want to mention something else that I find so interesting. You know, the Masterpiece Theater adaptations of, for instance, a lot of Dickens' novels. So Bleak House, there was a very wonderful adaptation of Bleak House, oh, maybe 5-6 years ago. I don't remember exactly. And it was shown in the UK. I happened to be in London at the time, in weeknight 30-minute installments. When it was aired here in the US, it was shown in, I think it was an hour and a half or 2 hour installments. Very, very different. And what I noticed when I was viewing it in London is I would hear people talking about last night's installment. I mean, it seemed to generate a lot more conversation.
To have it in the shorter bits.
Yeah. Yes, having it in shorter bits where people are returning each, you know, night.
You're more likely to be able to read or hear or see the entire episode that way and have a greater appreciation for it.
Right, and that's exactly what it appeared to me, that those 30-minute episodes that were on television in the UK were somewhat following the serial installments. I don't think there were quite 20, but it was closer to that than the way Bleak House was aired here.
We're going to get into some examples of novels published serially when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Omitted to mention in its place that there was someone else at the family dinner party. It was not a lady. It was a gentleman. It was a gentleman of a dark complexion, a young surgeon. He was rather reserved, but I thought him very sensible and agreeable. At least Ada asked me if I did not, and I said yes. That's the end of the fourth installment of Charles Dickens' Bleak House, published in June 1852. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Susan Bernstein, and we are talking about Victorian serialization, the process of taking a long novel and bringing it to the public in weekly or monthly installments. If we turn to something like Bleak House, with its very complex plot, two narrators, heavy-duty themes having to do with the law and with murder and all kinds of things that happen, I can't even imagine what it would be like to have to break that into parts as Dickens was writing that. That must have been quite a challenge.
Yes, but again, he was writing it as it was being published. So he, you know, he had an idea. He had his different, you know, narrative networks, as one colleague of mine, Caroline Levine, often describes Bleak House's structure. But he would tweak them as he continued. But Bleak House is such an interesting case because, of course, there are two different narrators. There's an unidentified third-person narrator, and there is the first-person narrator, Esther Summerson, who is a main character. And one of the things that you notice if you are reading by part issue numbers, the serial installments, is that of the 20 different installments, there's only one in which Esther has all of the installment. It is her narration, her voice that tells the story throughout that installment. And I believe there's only one or two where you have the unidentified narrator who has the whole installment. For the most part, they alternate.
And Dickens is doing that so that you don't lose track that this is a two-narrator book.
I would think so. And again, it's the variation, which is part of the appeal of the way he shaped
variation
his...
Variation of the voices.
Right. The mm-hmm. way he shaped his serial novels, that there's a variation in terms of focusing on different plot lines, focusing on different characters, different kinds of stories that are going on, and you get to see how they intersect and intertwine.
So was he given a page length that he was sort of shooting for with the magazine, a particular length? And is it usually about two chapters, three chapters in an installment?
The magazine installments tended to be the weekly ones, and they would be shorter. Okay, and Dickens he edited two magazines, and he ran, I think, a total of four novels, two in each.
What would be the difference? I keep thinking of Sir Walter Scott and all those Waverley novels, mm-hmm. and you stack up, cover a couple of board feet on anyone's bookshelf. What would be the difference between something like that and serializing that we get into a little later with Dickens?
I think the difference there has to do with the series as opposed to a serialized novel. Okay, so a series, and there were Victorian writers like Trollope, Anthony Trollope, who also wrote a series. But a series like Waverley, they would be novels that are thematically connected and might have overlapping characters, but it's not one continuous story or several multi-plotted storylines going on as Dickens serials were.
As far as fiction today, if you go to sell a book to any number of agents or publishers, they're likely to say, well, can there be a second one? Can there be
yes.
a series? I mean, it's all about series now. I mean, some going all the way through the alphabet, And the serial, on the other hand, seems less common in literature. Am I wrong about that?
I think there are definitely serials, and I think electronic publishing has brought that back into view in a way. But I also think what you're suggesting there, it has to do with the sequel, which is
sure.
a little bit different. And there we might think about the second season of Mad Men or whatever as a kind of sequel or continuation.
What about something like Sherlock Holmes, when Arthur Conan Doyle is publishing, he's got a recurring character and a series of stories. How does that fit in with a sort of serialization?
We wouldn't say The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. That's not one continuous plot or novel. But they are stories with characters, Watson and Holmes, certainly, and other ones as well, who recur. But they're more episodic. So, A Scandal in Bohemia or... can you think of a title?
Well, The Hound of the Baskervilles would be an exception, wouldn't it?
Right. That's an earlier one I was thinking of.
And he published Study in Scarlet.
Mm-hmm. Right. By the Orange Pips.
Right. Many of these published in The Strand, which was a popular weekly magazine. Each of those stories might be, are self-contained as episodes. So the stories themselves are connected, but each one isn't vital to the other one. And I think in a serialized Dickens novel, for instance, there is much more integration.
Well, you certainly get closure at the end of each Sherlock Holmes story.
Right.
Those are
right.
pretty well hermetically sealed despite the connections among them.
Right.
Are there famous examples of mistakes that get made if you're in your 14th episode and you forget that you killed off an aunt in installment three? Or are there examples where a novelist kind of forgets a detail and gets it wrong?
Well, I think that can happen, in any length of a novel or however it's written, right? And there are consistencies. I can't think of, a famous mistake. But I can think of Our Mutual Friend, which was the very last 20-part issue serial that Dickens completed, came out in 1864 to 1865. There's a character in that novel called Mr. Boffin. And readers expressed their dislike about what was happening with him, that he was mean-spirited and all sorts of things like that. So Dickens changes the character, and it ends up being a kind of act or performance in order to test another character. But there's quite a bit of evidence that that was a change of plan. So that's not a mistake per se, but it's certainly something that his readers prompted him to view as a mistake or something he needed
to. Were there books of the time that the author would think or the public would think, this is just too tight to be serialized? I keep thinking of A Picture of Dorian Gray, for example, the Oscar Wilde. I mean, that book is so tight that I can't imagine it as a serial. And I don't know if there was ever a plan to do that or other books that in Victorian times were just a little too compact.
You know, I'm very interested that you mentioned that novel because, in fact, now I'm not sure if it was serialized. I wish I could check. I know it was published in a magazine. So I don't know how to answer that, but I will say that the serial form, you know, it had its heyday in the middle of the 19th century, starting with Pickwick Papers, 1836, 37, and through the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, it started to decline.
Why do you think that is? What had changed in society that would explain
or was it?
It
just a medium that had kind of run its course for popular consumption?
It could be either one, but I think there were, you know, typically what would happen would be like with a Dickens novel or, you know, popular novels like sensation novels by Wilkie Collins or Mary Elizabeth Braddon. They would come out in the weekly or monthly installments. And then at the very end of the run, the volume form or the three-volume form, which would be then a subscription commodity that the, you know, circulating libraries could use, would come out. And then there'd be a really cheap one-volume form called a railway version that the idea was...
The Reader's Digest condensed book version?
It wasn't abridged, but it was, you know, smaller print and one volume and much, much cheaper. And they would be for sale at, you know, W.H. Smith's booksellers in a station, you know, like Euston Station or something like that in London, that travelers, I mean, it also, you know, we also have to keep in mind how transportation changed in the 19th century. And people would pick up a one-volume novel to read. But there definitely was a decline in the serial form in terms of long novels.
How important were the illustrations that sometimes came out along with these installments?
Well, in Dickens, I wanted to just describe maybe a little in a little bit more detail what Dickens' part issue numbers looked like. So they looked like pamphlets. In fact, I want to also mention special collections at Memorial Library here because they have a complete set, with the exception of Our Mutual Friend, of all of Dickens' original serialized novels. So you can actually go up there and look at those original part issue numbers. And they're little booklets, either with blue or green covers, wrappers, with the same design on the cover of each one. And there are there's also 32 pages of advertising surrounding the chapters, which is important to keep in mind. Yes, and it used to be that librarians would just rip those pages out because it was ephemera, it was of no value. But that's changed in recent years, and scholars want to look at how readers are also looking at these products. And what's fascinating is a lot of the advertising is absolutely playing on the particular
content of
yes,
the book.
Yes.
You mean in terms of here's a beauty product, right, when we're talking about appearance? Or?
Yes, yes. So, for instance, with Nicholas Nickleby, because I've spent time with these part issues up in special collections, there's a portrait painter named Miss La Creevy. And in the advertising material surrounding the chapter installments of the novel, there are advertisements for buying sketches or sort of portraits of the characters in the novel as painted by Miss La Creevy.
Wow.
And each subsequent installment adds another character that has been introduced in that installment. So it's actually very clever marketing.
Would Dickens have gotten a cut of that? Or was that licensing that specific at that point?
I don't know those details.
But interesting what you say about the ephemera, you know, and the advertising being torn out by librarians, because the same phenomenon in another thing that's a form of serial, we can maybe get into a little bit later, comic books in the 1940s, you know, during the paper mm-hmm. drives during the war. Well, the kids would tear out the commercials right. in the comic books. And so now if you get one that says, oh, my goodness, the commercials in it, the ads in it, that's much more valuable.
Right. But just to go back to the question about the illustrations. So what a part issue number of a Dickens novel looks like, a little pamphlet, cover blue or green with the same drawings on it, very interesting drawings, and many different drawings almost to capture the sense of, you know, a very big canvas. And then all the advertising, 16 pages before the chapters, 16 pages after, and then before the actual text of the chapters begin, two illustrations. Those two illustrations work as previews, right? Sort of visual previews, because they're not lined up with the chapter or the text that they're illustrating that moment, but they're in the front before, you know, after the first set of advertisements, before you start the chapters.
What sort of advertising are we talking about? Sort of an etching? Are we talking about a full color plate, or what were these?
The illustrations.
Like?
Mm-hmm. The illustrations. Well, they're often reproduced in these different editions. I just
the ones I've seen are sort of, they look like black and white line drawings. But I don't know if that's just because of the cheap paperback versions I have of them.
That is what they look like. Mm-hmm. They are like this. They are they're drawings. They're basically drawings. And they, you know, and like George Cruikshank was one of the, you know, main illustrators. Hablo Brown was another one who did the illustrations for Dickens serials. There were other, I mean, John Everett Millais, who was became a very, you know, prominent Pre-Raphaelite painter, he actually did the illustrations for, I think, one of Trollope's novels. And we, you know, which I think is interesting to think about. But yes, they're drawings, basically.
And how cheap were they? Let's say if you put it in today's economic terms, if I wanted to buy one installment of Bleak House, how much in today's money, roughly, would it cost me to buy an installment?
I'm never good with those conversions, but I would think around the price of a magazine. Mm-hmm. And also at the end of the run of the installments, the publishers would issue these cases in which someone who has purchased all of the part issue numbers could then place, you know, the 19 different booklets. And I think Memorial has some of those.
It sounds, though, at least as if the advertising was all at one end of the book or the other and not scattered throughout.
No, it wasn't scattered. It was in the front and the back. Mm-hmm. But it was not in the middle.
And can you tell us about the whole Little Nell situation with people waiting in America for the installment?
I mean, my understanding is, you know, Magazine Day, as it was called, was, you know, and it was sort of practiced in different ways in the UK and in the United States, but that would be when the next installment would be released to the public. And of course, with the U.S., they would come across, though actually, I think most of them were actually printed in the U.S., so I'm not really sure about this particular story you're
Maybe
referring
it's apocryphal where people line the shore waiting for the next installment. But
I think that's what it is, that they're waiting for the next installment. There was a huge amount of piracy going on because there were not international copyright laws until the end of the 19th century. Dickens was especially unhappy with the United States. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I learned is that his novels were pirated and serialized everywhere. I came across a copy of the Milwaukee Daily Sentinel from 1850 something that had installments of Little Dorrit, you know, in the middle of the week, like a couple of chapters, not in the particular serial installment of four chapters or three chapters that Dickens used. Another surprise that most people don't know about is that Frederick Douglass, who edited several magazines, one of which was called Frederick Douglass's Magazine, he ran a complete serialization of Bleak House in that magazine.
With obviously no payments to Dickens or
anyone
else.
No, it was a problem that went on for a long time. Gilbert and Sullivan had big problems with copyright a little later in the 19th century in this country.
Right, right.
Which authors would you say really rise to the top of handling this form, of making the most out of a serialization?
I would say Dickens, and then I would also point to some of the so-called sensation fiction writers, like Wilkie Collins, who was a good friend of Dickens, and Braddon, Mary Elizabeth Braddon. Because we think of those novels like The Moonstone or The Woman in White or Lady Audley's Secret as page-turners, cliffhangers, and they really do exploit that form. So the installment ends in a place where there is some lingering mystery or there's some little detail that comes up right at the end of that installment. I mean, with Lady Audley's Secret, it's always somebody coming upon a mysterious object. Oof. And where does this come from? And how is this related to Lady Audley's past?
I can hear music rising as you're saying that, the way it is today, where if it's coming toward the end of a television episode, you can feel the music rising, the suspense.
Right. Yes. You know, and it's, you know, I guess we could make a comparison even to stage melodrama. If you have an act, maybe even to Shakespeare, if you have an act and it ends, and which is a kind of break, you want to make sure there's enough there that your audience is going to come back for the next installment.
We hope you'll come back for the next installment of University of the Air, which will come your way shortly. We'll resume this conversation, find out how serials are with us today in just a moment on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We have fattened the sheep for him before he kills it. Catherine turned away and stood staring at the blank door. Go to bed, said her father, and, as we don't go aboard till noon, you may sleep late. We shall probably have a most uncomfortable voyage.
From the novel Washington Square by Henry James, as read by our guest Susan Bernstein, who is looking into the fascinating phenomenon of serialization, particularly in novels of the mid-19th century. Now, more about this blog, Susan, that you keep. It literally is a weblog. It's a, if not day-to-day, a week-to-week reaction on your part to installments from these famous books.
Right. It's called Serial Readers, and currently we are reading Washington Square, Henry James' novel, which was published in 6 installments in 1880 in The Cornhill, a British magazine, as well as an American magazine, Harper's. And we don't think of Henry James in the same paragraph as Dickens in terms of suspense and serialization. But in fact, he did publish some of his novels in serial form, the early novels. So on my blog, which I've been doing for 3.5 years, we read on an installment a week a Victorian serial. And as I mentioned, I started it June of 18. I can't speak. I started in June of 2008 with Dombey and Son, and some of the other novels that I've done since then have included The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, The Small House at Allington by Anthony Trollope, Romola by George Eliot. 4 Dickens novels, actually. In addition to Dombey and Son, we've read Little Dorrit, Martin Chuzzlewit, and The Mystery of Edwin Drood.
The Mystery of Edwin Drood.
Yes.
Why that one of all? Because it is it saying too much to say out there in blogland? It doesn't have an ending.
It doesn't have an ending, and it's short. It's 6 installments because it doesn't have an ending. So that sometimes it's hard for readers to keep up. with this slow reading practice, where they want to rush ahead and see what happens.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I mean, what's the ideal way to use your blog?
The ideal way is to think about reading one of these long, bulky Victorian novels or any novel as part of a general reading diet where you're reading, you know, simultaneously you're moving between different kinds of reading, right? So it's not the only reading that you're doing.
So you would read, though, a prescribed dose of this book,
yes,
and separately, and then on your blog, Susan, they would find your responses to it, and then they would add their own responses to it.
Yes. So my own practice with this is every Sunday I read the chapters that form that installment. It might be three chapters, might be four. With this Washington Square, it's often five or six. They're short chapters, but there are five or six chapters. Roughly 30 pages. I read that installment every Sunday, and it's just part of my routine. And then, usually on Monday or Tuesday, I post an entry about the latest installment. And then other serial readers post their comments. Occasionally, I've had guests, bloggers, who post the initial comment, which is a lot of fun. Sometimes when I've been traveling or for other reasons, I've asked people who've been reading the novel, would you do the lead-off post on this particular installment?
I'm going to say it's unfortunate in a way that you couldn't use this as an actual classroom device, but it would take so long, wouldn't it, that it wouldn't be practical from a semester standpoint.
Except you mentioned you did that in the semester, just sort of spreading out over 15 weeks.
Right,
kind of doing
and actually, really, then you would respond to the students' blogs in response to your reading.
Right. It would definitely be possible to do that. I was just talking to somebody who said that he has his students buy very cheap Dover editions of these, you know, the Dickens novel or a Collins novel, and he has them bring them the first class, and then he takes them from them, and he rips out the first installment of the book, and they're horrified he's ripping up a book. But that way they don't have the rest of the novel. So they have to come back and get – they can't go ahead. They can't peek ahead.
So I'm thinking one way to use your blog would be if there's a novel, let's say, that we've always wanted to read and it just seems too intimidating, the length of it, with mm-hmm. our busy lives, that to know that you could handle a small amount and then there would be this sort of friendly, encouraging response so mm-hmm. that you're not reading alone would be a nice way. So as you go – you're about to post the – response to the final installment of Washington Square, and then what? What's coming next on your blog?
I'm always open to suggestions, but I find that my serial reader community is usually very happy to go along with what I suggest. So the one that I'd like to do next is Dickens' The Old Curiosity Shop with Little Nell. Yes.
A lot of handkerchiefs coming out.
Yes. And so the plan is to begin that the middle of February. So I would estimate around the 13th, 14th, 15th of February.
I was struck on your website that you talk about the relationship between serial publication and things today, such as, well, iPads and Twitter and all that. Help us understand how the things we're doing now are in some way related.
I wanted to mention, I should say I have some interesting links on my blog to websites and to one particular format for reading novels serially that I'm going to mention now called Daily Lit. So if viewers do go to or whatever you...
Listeners could go to
my serial readers Dickens blog, and you'll find these links. But let me just describe quickly Daily Lit. Daily Lit is this format that has many, many different novels and stories, including many of the Sherlock Holmes stories available. You sign up and you say how you want to receive installments. These are not the installments in terms of length in which they were initially written at all. They're more like 4, 5, 6 paragraphs, and they're designed to be read on your cell phone when you're waiting for a doctor's appointment or you're on the bus going to work.
Not while driving, please.
Not while driving, right? Or they can be read on a laptop. But you get to say how you want them delivered. Do you want to get one a day? Do you want to get one daily throughout the 7 days of the week? Do you only want to get them every other day? You get to say, but then it's delivered to you. So when I learned about Daily Lit, I decided I'm going to read David Copperfield this way. That was why they have, you know, they keep developing more and more novels in this electronic format for people to read, and you subscribe to it. So it's also like the Victorian subscription libraries in a way, only it's free. And I started reading David Copperfield this way instead of the 20 installments, which was the way in which Dickens initially wrote David Copperfield. Daily Lit delivers something like 448 installments.
Now, what keeps that from feeling like you're, I don't know, putting together a jigsaw puzzle with little pieces that I would think it almost would start to feel fragmented?
I myself was not able to keep up. I was, I would say, through, I don't know, the first 50 installments, which amounted to maybe 6 chapters, something like that, maybe a little bit further. But I suppose, and I haven't talked to other people who've used it, but if you sort of put it into your daily life so that you read one installment, you woke up, you read one on your bus to work, you read one during lunchtime, you read one on the bus ride home from work, you read one right before you turned out the light at night, then you would be reading in those pieces something more like a couple of mm-hmm. chapters. And if you did this in a daily way, then I think you could keep the thread.
I'm reminded, though, of a book I have. It's pretty funny, but it's called The 5-Minute Iliad and Other Instant Classics for the Short Attention Span. Mm. But it's kind of making fun of the yes. fact that we can't seem to handle
right.
a book anymore. I mean, is there a danger in the emphasis on short pieces that we are kind of indulging our own
short attention yeah. span?
Yes, but that here I think you're alluding to abridged versions. And the thing about
that's true.
The
that's true.
Daily Lit is it is not abridged. There is not a word omitted.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, though, it is trying to make some kind of compromise with that, you know, short attention span problem.
Right. That's true that it isn't abridged. And, you know, one thing that my mother has done for a lot of years is to read 10 minutes a day of mm-hmm. something hard. It's not her only reading, but she'll do 10 minutes a day, and she's gotten through King Lear and just all
exactly
kinds
that.
Of wonderful works by just doing 10 minutes a day.
The serial had sort of a resurgence, didn't it, when that medium radio came along, and then television after.
Yes,
and even
I think
to some extent,
true.
Films or the old Buck Rogers serials, for example.
Yes, absolutely.
And here on Wisconsin Public Radio, where there's chapter a day, certainly the idea
yes.
of getting part of a book mm-hmm. is still very much with us.
Yes.
Well, thank you for being with us this hour, Susan Bernstein.
Thank you.
It's gone quickly, and you got it all in 3 convenient installments. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next University of the Year.